The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on February 23, 2020. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning. Good to see you all today on this nice sunny day. A 1L Lama is a priest. A 2L Lama is a beast. But I bet a silk pajama you'll never see a 3L Lama. That's a little ditty by Ogden Nash. My oldest brother, Dale, he was 12 years older than me. And he recited that for me, as well as many others when I was little. And he loved Ogden Nash. And he would write a lot of, not just Ogden Nash-like poems, but he would write poems. And after he died, there was a whole collection of his stuff that he'd written over the years. Anyway, he introduced me to Ogden Nash. And at a time when I didn't know what a 1L Lama was. I knew what a 2L Lama was, but I didn't know what a 1L Lama was. But also, my brother, he introduced me to Buddhism when I was 7 or 8 years old. He was in college already at this point. And somewhere he took, I don't know what the course was, but took some kind of a course on Buddhism, or involved Buddhism anyway. And he told me about the Buddha's life and all of this, and even the Anatta doctrine, which I could tell intrigued him quite a bit. It intrigued me. I couldn't get it at all, as most of us don't, even adults. But anyway, but he would write little things like this, and longer poems too, and often very humorous. So he wrote this one. I want to read it for you here now. I could have had it memorized. I sort of do. It's short enough. But just to make sure I don't flub it up here. He titled this one, Putting Science to Work. The waitress brings me coffee. I add cream to the cup. I ask her not to bring a spoon. Convection stirs it up. So this is my brother Dale. Yeah, the waitress brings me coffee. I add cream to the cup. I ask her not to bring a spoon. Convection stirs it up. Well, but in thinking about that, the matter that convection stirs it up, with my morning coffee this morning, Ann and I were talking about certain things in relation to that. And I was just pointing out how, you know, in a room, say, if you were to introduce something, well, I was going to say about the convection stirs up, but it was just the random act of motion of the molecules in the cup that stir it up, you know. As long as it's a liquid like cream, it'll mix into the coffee. If it's a solid like sugar, you might want to stir it. And you can stir your cream too. It's more efficient, I suppose. But if you bring something into a room, some kind of, just say a little container of, let's just say argon, since argon is in our atmosphere, you know, trace amounts. But you have a little canister there of argon, and then you just open it up. And quite naturally, in a little bit of time, the argon will disperse into the room and spread out evenly into the room, and quite naturally. I remember my mother once asking about this. I was talking to her about, you know, stuff like this, that these things would just naturally disperse. And she wanted to know why. See, my mother, she was a very devout Christian, and she believed in God, and she believed that a lot of the forces and actions of nature were kind of directed by God. She would have this. This was her understanding, her belief. And she'd want to know, well, how could this just happen, you know? And for her, God would move everything. But I just said, well, you know, the molecules are jostling about. You introduce some new material, some new gaseous material, say a heavy gas, that might be a little different than this, but it will disperse into the atmosphere. And the reason for this is because all these molecules are, as they're vibrating very quickly, much more quickly than I could gesture with my fingers here, bouncing off each other and this sort of thing, randomly. Well, of these, say, if they're argon molecules or whatever, you know, atoms, they would randomly bounce here and there in various ways. But as they do, the place where there is either no argon or less argon, there's much more territory without the argon than there is with argon. And so just quite naturally and randomly, they will tend to go into those areas more than they would bouncing back into the center of the cloud of argon there or whatever the gas might be. And so quite naturally, this will just continue and continue and continue until eventually it would be evenly dispersed throughout the room or the atmosphere or wherever, whatever it is we're talking about here. And it would just kind of even out at that point. It won't become any more random. You know, once it hits, you know, true randomness, it's going to just stay random, though continuously moving and changing. So this is very natural. This is the way you think, you know, we don't need to call in any special, you know, force or something like this to explain these kinds of actions. And the same thing too, like if we you know, look at something like the way that our solar system formed out of a nebulous cloud of gas and dust and this sort of thing. And I remember talking to my mother about this, that this too would just naturally form. And it would be rotating. The planets would be going around the sun. The sun is spinning and the planets are spinning and turning. The moons around them are also in orbit around the different planets and this sort of thing. And quite naturally, this would happen. Well, why? I mean, you don't need somebody coming along and, you know, like people in the Middle Ages, they thought that there were angels up there pushing along the planets in their orbits and things like this. Because it seemed like you need something there to put it in motion like that. And, well, actually, that's not really true. Quite naturally, if you have a gaseous cloud of gas and dust, quite naturally, what's going to happen, just by gravity, the different particles and things will start coming together. You know, just over a long period of time, and pretty soon they start to clump together in various places. And in these places where little clumps are forming, they would have a little bit more gravity pulling in even more things and more things. And eventually, different bodies, such as the planets and the moons, and we begin to form. And of course, in the center piece, you know, the big one there, become the sun in the case of our solar system, or countless other solar systems you might want to observe. But this is all natural. And of course, they would be set to spin. My mother couldn't understand, well, why would they spin? I mean, you know, there must be something. Well, the spinning is also quite natural because as these various things are coming together here and there, and unless they're all coming together in a perfectly balanced way, you know, some material coming in from this direction and just its opposite direction, pointing right at the very same center, unless that was occurring, which would be quite miraculous if it did, short of that, it's going to spin. Why? Well, because of these pieces, they kind of pass by each other and then they start looping around like this, and pretty soon they'll start gathering and forming into little orbits and things and turns and spins, and all this is quite natural. And the tighter things get pulled in, the faster they, just like with the skater, you know, she brings in her arms and begins to spin ever faster. So the spinning part of it is, again, quite natural. It's just a matter of, you know, looking at these things and just kind of seeing their natures. and how they behave in the way that they do. Of course, then you might ask, well, then well, what about gravity? Where is this coming from? And I could get into that too, but that would drag us into, because Newton didn't understand it either. He understood to how to describe it and how it worked and all of this sort of thing. But what is the gravity exactly? Well, now we need Einstein in that, but we don't need to go that far. But we could continue on with this, and in every case, you're going to find that this is just given the situation that we have here. We're going to have a world that kind of ends up looking pretty much like the one that we have here, quite naturally. And so, very naturally, then, because you're wondering where this is going, obviously, maybe you've already can see it. It just brings us to the precepts, which quite naturally comes out of this. Oh, I thought you might find that humorous, but because maybe it isn't quite so obvious. But it's the same sort of thing, and this is what I want to talk about today: the precepts. Point out some things about it in a way that I haven't before. These are quite natural systems, natural ways that things. What we're after here is observing and noticing. Well, it's a very natural way to live and to behave and to carry out your life. We can find it here in the Buddhist precepts. You know, point to this in a very natural way. You don't need any hidden occult or outside force or whatever to be at play here in any way whatsoever. Just given, here we are, this is it, here it is, and there's a way in which we can live and interact with each other and our environment and everything. It's very harmonious, peaceful. Because if we try to apply something to make it go or to explain it as to how these things work and that sort of thing, I'm going to find it very difficult to come up with a system of morality that ultimately makes any kind of sense without reaching to pointing to something that's, well, just laying down the law. This is what you have to do. Which, unless we can see, well, why? Why this? Why that? It's very hard for us to, if we think about it, if we look at it, we can just trust that and say yes, you know, and there probably is, if we follow these laws, very often it would be the case that we are going to live in a more harmonious way, if we go ahead and do that. But it isn't at all obvious as to, well why though? And even like in philosophy, I remember this really fascinated me way back when I was studying philosophy in college, and looking at the various systems of truth. Philosophers, they want to, how do we get to truth here? How can we point to it? We have these different truth theories that they would invent. Because this is very important, because if we want to have true knowledge of the world and of our lives and the workings of all of this and how to live and all of this, to have true knowledge, it involves that we have to have, the only thing we can really have knowledge about, true knowledge, is truth, it would seem. And this is really quite sound. I could go into that, but I don't want to take the time here for that. But I think if you just think about it for a minute, to have knowledge, if what you have knowledge about isn't actually true, in what sense is that even knowledge? Something else, belief or speculation or just trying to control something for your own ends and this or that. It's anything but truth and knowledge. So philosophers are very interested in this, and they would devise these various truth theories. And there's quite a spread of them. Most philosophers, though, embrace, but only by maybe a slight margin, embrace what's called the correspondence theory of truth. And most of us actually kind of follow that in our own life, whether we know about this or not. But the correspondence theory is true, that just basically, I know that there's a Zafu over there, and so I have this knowledge, and that's the truth, because I can see it. I'm quite sure that if I walked over there and touched it, I could feel it. So that's the correspondence. My idea of a Zafu over there, a cushion, sitting cushion, corresponds to with that image that I can see. We can all see it over there. Or this microphone here. That's called a correspondence theory of truth. And there's other ones. There's coherence theory, quite a few, and pragmatism. And there's a variety of coherence theories as well. But philosophers have a hard time with all of these, including the correspondence theory. Because if you're going to base any kind of system of knowledge or and morality, say, on truth theory that we have, the correspondence theory, see? In the case of the correspondence, and every one of these truth theories, they've been able to pick them up, they just keep picking them apart, and yet they keep trying to change them and construct them so that they'll have something that will work, and they never find one. There's a reason for this, which we'll be looking at here in a minute. We'll get to the precepts. But in the case of this correspondence theory, the one that philosophers themselves will use to pick it apart is the fact that, well, it doesn't really help us as to determining the truth of, say, like that murder is wrong. Because unlike, say, the truth of this cushion being over there is because I can point to it. There is a cushion. You know, we can go over, we can see it, we can touch it. You know, there's a cushion over there. And so we can point to something to verify that truth. But of course, even that alone won't ultimately hold up. But we don't have to go there. But they'll say, these philosophers then who argue against correspondence theory, they'll say that, well, what would you point to confirm the truth that murder is wrong? And they can't really point to anything to hold anything up that can't be torn down. So it seems to be a theory, and it keeps being revised and changed and all kinds of all the various truth theories that they come up with. They're never able to settle on anything. And there's a reason for this. And they never will. I explain all this, I point to it at least in my book that it'll be coming out next summer now. I don't spend a lot of time with this, but I just kind of pointed out that we're missing some major thing here. Namely, that there's our deep, staunch belief in substantiality or non-emptiness is the problem here. In Buddhist thinking and understanding, at least from, I shouldn't even say Buddhist, but it really is the understanding of the awakened and how they see our situation here. They see it in a radically different way, where you do not need to rely on some dictum, some theory, some doctrine, some authority pointing to this or that, saying this is how it is, this is true, this is what is good, this is that's evil over there, and that sort of thing. Those systems, ultimately, they fail. And philosophers for 2,000 years and more have been tearing their hair out trying to find something that doesn't fail. But they're just going about it in the wrong way, with the belief that there is something that we can grab hold of and say that there it is, this is the truth, this is real, this is genuine, some object of some sort, some whether it's a physical object or a thought or a feeling or a belief. And these things will always fail. Nagarjuna shows us this. Quite naturally, they will fail. But also quite naturally. That's why I was talking about nature here. If we just observe what is actually taking place here without, you know, dragging in our beliefs or assumptions, say in substantiality or any number of other things, we can find something that doesn't fail. In fact, that actually matches the very reality that we are living out from moment to moment. And there is morality in it, or an ethical way to live. Without justification, without resorting to, you know, something that leaves you kind of wondering, well, what do you base this on? Maybe you're going to point to an authority or something else, or this is just the rule of law, but it's always not satisfying. But there is a way that we can wake up to, open our eyes to, actual truth, reality, and observing and realizing the nature of it, it points directly to how one might live their life. To be completely upright and moral and sane and fair. And I don't want to use a word like good, because we'll end up, you know, pitting that against something else that we'll call evil. And we're going to start fighting again. And we'll make up rules about it. And that doesn't work. It just simply doesn't work. So there is something different. And the precepts point to this. They're not dictums. They're not commandments. They're not thou shalts and thou shalt nots. They're not structured that way. You know, we have the precept not to kill. You're not commanded by some questionable authority. Thou shalt not do that. Are you talking about murder here? And you're pointing to something that will support that, but it's always dubious. Now, we can just simply see this. Well, what's pointed out in the precepts is just pointing out that one who's awake doesn't carry on in this way. One who's awake does not kill. Of course, we'll think then, okay, so there are some people here who are awake and then they don't kill, you know. But that's not what's being pointed out exactly. It's just that with awakeness, one does not kill. And they're not doing this out of some rule or law, some dictum that says you should, you know, thou shalt not. It's just that in seeing the way things are in this way, they would live in a way that doesn't involve killing. But then exactly what exactly is killing? We have to look at this too. Are we just simply talking about something like murder? You know? Well, no. A lot of Buddhists become vegetarian because they don't want to kill animals. Still, you kill the carrots and the onion and the whatever it is that you, you know, the celery, as you chop it up to eat it or cook it. And, you know, you just want to avoid that. Well, in the extreme case, I guess maybe you just have to stop eating. But even when you're breathing, you're killing microorganisms that are in the air, and this or that, and plenty of them die just being breathed in by you. We live in a world where this sort of thing is going on. So what exactly is this, and what exactly is killing, and where does this take place? Well, it has everything to do, and what it is that the awakened see, it has to do with your mind. And these precepts all have, whether they're the pure precepts or the what are called the grave precepts. A follower of the way does not kill. A follower of the way does not take what is not given. A follower of the way does not speak deceptively. If we're living out of seeing wholeness and totality, out of which galaxies will spin in relation to virtually everything else, and all of these kinds of things are here, we can also see this in terms of, well, how we can live our life. And there's a way to live in which our mind is coming out of wholeness rather than out of some gripped view, either about myself and how I want to do things to make me feel more comfortable or better or safe or whatever. And keep away, stop, kill even, those kinds of things out there, or people or situations that threaten me. There's a way to live without this, and not to do it out of any kind of rule or dictum or shaming and blaming, but out of just simply naturally seeing the workings of the whole thing here and how this operates, how it plays out, without grabbing hold of any kind of a dictum or a belief or anything of this sort. And this is why they are called precepts, not commandments, not dictums, not even laws, but precepts. Just take the Latin root of this word here. Pre, of course, means before. And sept, which comes from the term septus, which means to grasp, to take hold of. So before we grasp And just grasping with, even before we grasp, maybe even with the hand, but certainly before we grasp with the mind, before we take hold of some kind of concept or belief or some rule that we think we have to live by, because my gosh, we just can't live in a ruleless sort of way. Yeah, well, no, probably not. But to, in the end, ultimately, to feel like we have to reach back, and we hit that barrier, that wall, where we're relying on something. The Buddha points out in various places, but you can also find it. Well, you can find it in the Kakkaya Nagoda Sutra. But in various places, point out that you can live in a way in which you are not other dependent. You're not dependent on some other formed thing external to you. Of course, you yourself, in living in this way, you don't have any seeing of yourself as some formed thing, separate and apart from other, or others, or from the world, or living, what, wholly apart from totality, or something like that. Because when we do wall ourselves off as an individual separated entity here of some sort, and then deeply believe that and live totally out of that understanding, well, we're living in a way as if we are cut off from everything else. And now there will be all kinds of perceived threats. I'll use perceived in a normal way, that word is used, you know, but threats and delights and all of that. And where we're, you know, just tossed about left and right. So there is a way to live free of this, and to live free of laws and dictums and these precepts. They're not laws, they're not commandments, they're not rules, they're not dictums. Because those do not work. They do not work in the end. In some limited ways they might seem to. But you're still bound. If you're following something like that, you're still living as if in a dungeon heaped with chains. You're not free. And you do not understand how free you are, quite naturally. So these precepts then, if we understand them correctly, both the pure precepts and even the triple treasure as well, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, but also the pure precepts. Well, basically they come from, you can find them there in that 183rd verse of the Dhammapada. To do what is wholesome, to do what is of the whole, not of the part, not of the self. To avoid what is unwholesome, what is of the self or the part or the fractured or the divided. You know, to do what is wholesome, to avoid what is unwholesome, to purify your own mind, or as I often just simply put it, just watch your mind. To purify your mind isn't somehow to get in there and pass everything through a sieve or a filter or something like this. Or did you watch your thoughts? There's nothing like this at all. That's always just grasping, 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 grasping. There's no morality to be found in that. Ultimately, in the end, you won't find one that continues to stand. You'll get up against an impasse at some point, if we're hanging on to anything like that at all. So it's just simply, you know, watch your mind. Purify your own mind. Realize when it is that you are grasping, you're taking hold of something, you're holding on to a belief, you think that this is right and true and correct, against something else that is not. We're living out of a kind of a confined confusion there. And of course, most of us live out of this continuously, and so it's hard for us to realize that there's a way to live and to understand and to realize your life without resorting to things of this nature. Now we can just see what is taking place here. So watch your mind. And then we have the grave precepts of just reminding us that one who is awake, they do not steal. They do not lie. They do not kill. They do not praise self. They don't slander others. They don't speak deceptively, or you know these. But again, this is to really see what these are, and these are just pointing out something. You're not condemned if you step off this path, this way of awakening. You said something that really isn't quite right. And of course, ultimately, you can't say anything that's truly right or correct. Or, but again, and I think I've already mentioned this, but again, this takes us right back to that this is about your mind. So in speaking, if there's some will or you know notion in your mind, where you're trying to bring about some particular result, whether it favors you maybe in some way or favors your friends, or in the other way that maybe to inflict some punishment or revenge or whatever, or even some kind of self-loathing and hatred directed at yourself. Just avoid these, to recognize when this is taking place in your mind, and to realize that the true understanding of the nature of this reality doesn't require that of you at all. You do not need to take hold of anything. And I pointed out in Buddhism, plain and simple, that the simple way to really observe this is just observe your own mind. To learn to see if their mind is leaning one way or another, toward or away from anything. And you can feel this. It isn't a matter that you need to analyze this and get thoughts and ideas and words and judgments here. You can feel. You're drawn toward this or away from that. And you're going to act out of that now, or speak out of that. Try to bring about some results, as a result from it. When the concern is basically either with myself or with, say, possibly my friends or my relatives, whatever. But, if that's what's behind this, then just avoid that. To start to recognize, what is taking place there. And don't expect to do this perfectly. I've been observing this now. I've understood this now, observed this now for 40 years or more now. And I can't do this perfectly at all. And that isn't the point, but we can begin to at least understand what this is. And all, if we're not watching this in a gentle way, we get pulled off into pain and misery and confusion and get ensnarled in all sorts of things once again. Little by little, by recognizing that and seeing how that works and how we get caught in these ways, we can learn to just not slide into it quite so easily and so fast, so quickly. And it isn't a matter that we get to some place where we operate now perfectly. I don't know that anybody can do that. But we can certainly move a long way from where we are now if we easily get caught and ensnarled in pain and difficulty and misery and confusion. Anger and hatred and all that, or excessive elation, and where we're just constantly looking for the party and just to be happy and all the time. So that's what these precepts are about then, and they can be taken up and observed in just this way, that they help us, they remind us to just once again really to just look at your own mind. Look at your own heart. Where are you operating from here? And sometimes we might find some kind of delight in, we're mad at somebody, and so we want to do something or get them on something or whatever. Just realize what that is and how miserable you are to be thinking this way. Be carrying on in this way. Is this really? How much pleasure and delight will you get from just getting somebody on something? As opposed to just see if you can just let that go. Maybe in your own heart you can even forgive them or take pity on them for what maybe they have done to you, or what you might have thought that they did. And you might not even really, in that case, even know what their heart was. So how can you even judge? But we can learn to live more and more out of this. It isn't any prescribed way, like what to do, but just it's more of just a matter of recognize what you are doing and recognize those things that get us caught in a lot of pain and misery. These things are of an unwholesome mind that is acting out of the partial and the part and the self and all of this that can never be found. It's a phantom, but nevertheless it tugs at us and pulls at us, whatever it is that we imagine is there, me. And the result is we're living out of anxiety and confusion, misery, never satisfied. So there's a way to be, that we can find that. So there's a way of, it's a way of freedom. And we can begin to see that. And well, we really can't see much there, actually, but we can see where we're being pulled away from that. You know, because there really isn't any particular place or idea or ideal state of mind or whatever to go to. It's just a matter, this is what enlightenment is, nothing more than recognizing delusion. How it is we're caught in the subtle ways that we're caught by this or that or the next thing. It's just a matter of learning to recognize that, to see that, and maybe then, you know, gradually develop the capacity to not keep stepping into all that all the time. Okay, so, there we are. Well, maybe I've said enough on this morning, but any questions or comments or arguments? Well, I want to say this too about the precepts. Probably don't say enough about these. I remember from years past anyway when we had a kind of a regular basic classes that we offered. And there would be the Four Noble Truths, kind of the basic overall teachings by the Buddha. Focusing then, the next class would be on the Eightfold Path, which is the Fourth Noble Truth. And those classes were pretty well attended. And then the next one in the series is focusing more on just the wisdom aspect of the Eightfold Path and dependent arising and the unlocatable self, anatta. I mentioned that my brother first pointed them out to me when I was a little kid and intrigued me, probably stuck with me the rest of my life. It was always sort of there, come back to it, look at it. So weird, what is that? And so that's kind of a little bit of a difficult course, gets pretty subtle. But then, so the attendance would kind of drop off a little bit in those classes. But that class provides a real opening into the deep, profound, subtle wisdom teachings that are available to us, that have been left behind by people who have awakened to what's going on here. Then we move from that class to the precept class, and that's where the attendance, the enrollment in the precept class of the five classes we would offer in this basic series of classes, that was the least attended. And yet that is the one where we look at the day-to-day living of one's life. That's where your pain and sorrow, if we don't understand this, there's where we're going to be entangled and caught. This is an absolutely vitally important class to learn more about these precepts and why they're there, why they've been, these things have been pointed out to us. And how free they really are. Of course, from the outside, and maybe it's the way they're approached often, even in Buddhism, where I've even seen it where they're listed as the Buddhist Ten Commandments. But they're not that. They're easily misunderstood, misread, and mistaught. And takes us back into our usual ideas about morality, which very often, ethics, morality, this is important. Look at what's going on in our government today, my gosh. This all is very important. But there's a kind of a stinkiness about it, too. Morality and holier than thou kind of thing. What are you going to tell me what to do? You know, all that kind of stuff. Because we don't. But there's a natural, free way to take these things up and to allow them to point out some stuff about how we're actually living our life and where the misery is coming from and the confusion and the fear, the trepidation. What is this all about? And I don't even know where I'm going. What? Here now, especially today, with we're about to plunge into some... What was it, last week on the News Hour? They had a thing on the Thwaites Glacier. Do you know where that? It's part of the West Antarctic ice sheet that could go at any time. And if it does, it'll raise the oceans by 10 feet. Can you imagine? Southeast Asia, there are huge rice fields within less than 10 feet of sea level. That's going to be wiped out. That's just one thing. We can go on and on. New Orleans, you know. And all the oil refinery stuff that's sitting right there on the coast, you know, that's going to be... We can just go on and on. Bangladesh, and of course, all the various island people that live around the globe. New York City, Statue of Liberty, is getting her ankles wet while she's up on a platform there, but probably won't be much of an island there, if any. But we just go on and on with this. And it's just, you know, one thing. But the Earth, we here on planet Earth, well, how many of these drastic science fiction movies we've seen of huge catastrophes that befall people? And of course, we're at a movie, so we're just looking at a movie. And what would happen if some huge thing happened, like whatever the story is about? Earthquakes or volcanoes or space aliens or what? We're heading right in to something like this. That West Antarctic ice sheet is going to collapse. It might collapse another 10 or 20 years, but it isn't that far out before the thing is going to go. And the oceans are going to rise. That's just one thing. So getting back to the precepts here again. And that class that we have on the precepts, that isn't very well attended. But this is all about finding within yourself the stability that comes with knowing the true situation that we are living with all the time. And the fact is, whether it's through this kind of huge catastrophe or whatever, but even within our own personal life, you know, we're all mortal. There's an issue. What are you going to do about that? Well, I will tell you that you can understand exactly what's going on there. And if you do, you won't be filled with trepidation and fear and anxiety. But that's available to us all. And you won't have to rely on some kind of belief or doctrine or, you know, teaching or stories of beautiful places you'll go to. Or hells, or without relying on anything like that at all, with just actually seeing what's truly taking place here and understanding it, this is available. And the awakened who wake up to this and realize what this is, and they leave behind things like the precepts, many other things as well. But this is about just day to day how you conduct your life. And how you can, but it's about the understanding that you're operating out of, not the rule or the dictum, or the thou shalt, because those don't work. And no awakened person would ever utter things like that. So there's great freedom in this for you to live your daily life. And even to withstand whatever might be coming. And I don't know what's coming exactly. I mean, but I think we can all be assured that things are not going to go on the way they have been for the last 7,000-8,000 years. We're rapidly heading toward living on a planet that won't resemble what most of humanity has lived through for thousands of years. I think we can almost be absolutely assured of that. Now, I'm old. I'm 74. I probably won't be around too much longer, but many of you are young. And I think of my grandchildren, you know. My granddaughter, she's turning 11 in a couple days, and my grandson is 7. What are they going to be? They get to be my age, if they can get to be my age. What's this world going to be like? But again, what I'm pointing to here is there's a way you can take care of this. And it is not shutting anything down or avoiding the facts and the realities that might be coming our way, but where you can remain calm and rational. Oh, I wanted to talk about that too, the Shikan, but that, I guess I'll save that for another talk sometime. No, I've talked about it before, but that's, again, this is also what is involved here. The tranquility and the of mind, you know, and the just staying here, present with it. No matter what assails you. So this is powerful, powerful stuff. And anyway, but the precepts, and working these through and looking at them, and then, of course, you have to take those up and reflect on your own life and how you're living it, because this is what it's commenting and pointing to. But there's a way that we can learn this and do this that will greatly ease the kind of vexations and difficulties that we naturally are faced with on a day-to-day basis. But I think for us now, we really are going to be faced with some pretty heavy things before long. Maybe another decade or two before it really gets. But it won't be long. And it could be any day. So anyway, I probably should stop. Yes, Peter.
The way that the precepts are written in our tradition here at Durham Field,
Yeah. The
last sentence seems to give a psychological context in which the precept would be acted out. You know, I've forgotten what they are, but thou shalt not kill, or whatever.
Well,
and then
the following way is not kill.
Something is equivalent to killing. And that part always fascinates me because it's not rational and clear.
Yeah.
Can you say a little bit about that comment?
Well, what it's doing there, it's throwing it open to the whole, and that's why it's not something easily grasped. And I was in the Bodhisattva and the Bodhidharma precepts here that not holding a view of extinction is called the precept of not to kill. So, not holding a view of extinction. Normally, and when we're living completely immersed and totally believing in the self here that I am and all of this, and there's a world out there and there's other beings out there separate and apart from me and they're distinct and separate, and yeah, this is true enough, but that's not the whole thing that's taking place here. And the life that's being lived isn't really even your life at all. It is a life of the whole. This is the Buddha nature. We'll be starting this discussions on that in a couple of weeks here now on Wednesday nights. And these will also be put online for audio subscribers too, for anybody listening might be listening to this talk, but where we'll get into these kinds of things. But this is the Buddha nature. But this is reality as it is and as it's unfolding here now, and this is what we are, this Buddha nature, this totality, this awareness, this life. It is not that I am something distinct and separate and I have my own life. Well, yes, in appearances, and that's how things appear to be. And that's true enough. That's kind of a small t truth and a small r reality. Yeah, we don't deny that. But that isn't the whole thing that's taking place here. What is actually unfolding here is taking place in totality, in wholeness. And so the precepts are then kind of helping us in our daily life, living from day to day and interacting with others and things like this, but holding it in a way where maybe we can kind of realize how we're actually living out of the whole itself. It's just, well, I already kind of pointed to it in the case of where, say, if in just observing your own mind, the leanings of your own mind, and leaning this way and that, to the extent that we are doing that and being caught by that and taken by that, we are caught up in self and acting in a way where we think that the ultimate reality that we're living out is, well, here I am something separate and apart from others, and you know, and we deeply believe that, that this is how it is. But this is nothing but suffering, and this is dukkha right there. And it's also dukkha connected with ignorance there, and we don't even realize that this is what's actually taking place. But we can slow down enough to learn to observe this and to see this. And the way out of this situation is to recognize, start to recognize what it is that seems to be pulling on me here and causing me to lean this way. I want this, I don't want that, you know, and so the mind begins to lean in these various ways. By observing this, and we start to realize the insanity that this is and the misery and pain that comes with it, the mind, quite naturally, of its own, will begin to straighten up, so to speak, and to not lean. And to the extent that it does, it begins to resemble the mind of the whole, the mind of totality, the mind of enlightenment. And so this is how we can find our way out of that. But that's why it's so vital that, like in the pure precepts there, and the one about purify your own mind, just observe your mind and your interactions with everyone and everything and what's taking place within your mind. You know. And without judgment, this is also absolutely vital, because it isn't bad that your mind leans. It's quite natural that your mind will lean if you absolutely believe in the substantiality, the non-emptiness of everything that's taking place around you, including yourself. But to the extent we can actually observe what is really taking place, we can actually see the non-substantiality of it all. And with this, the kind of stuff that grips the mind and causes it, pulls it to lean this way and that, starts to weaken. But all of this is coming about through just our direct observation and our kind of, can I say, dispassionate observation of this, you know, and without judgment. And without thinking, you know, that was bad the way I was doing it. That's our ordinary thinking again. And I got to get away from that, and I want to do this. This was better. Just start to recognize what that is, the leaning of mind itself. And the way that wholeness will take us out of this is, it's just that, but it won't be occurring with judgment in the mind at all. Discernment, perhaps. We need to just descry what is taking place, or descry, which is to see what is not easily seen. And what isn't easily seen is, well, reality and how we might live our lives in utter freedom, which, by the way, is what nirvana refers to, just total freedom. So these precepts and in those lines that you were kind of wondering about, they, if you just kind of look at them, and you can look at them in the sense that they're kind of directing our attention toward how it is that where the awakened are coming. It's directing it, us toward our perceptual experience, the perception of basically the seeing and the realizing of the whole of totality as opposed to the part. And so that, you know, they can be, you know, kind of seen in that way. So if you go back and look at them again, you might want to just kind of keep that in mind. It really opens them up, these precepts, and gives us a airy sense of freedom. Yeah. Well, we have gone over the hour now. Is that okay, Peter? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Oh. Okay. All right.
So this path, the wholeness, is a difficult even to get on, because there's so much more of this is than that is,
yeah,
kind of part of our backgrounds, etc. But where it's always occurred to me, even when I was young, that it was there, was being nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm not saying any particular way, but just to be there without a lot of that this and that.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, it doesn't even take much. You don't have to go out to Wyoming or some faraway place. I can walk down my block with my dog at sunrise, and it's right there.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was just what I wanted to say.
Yeah, yeah. It's just not even agree with you. I feel the same. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I've observed that too. I gave a talk on this a long time ago, but Ru Jing, Dogen's teacher in China, when Dogen was going to go back to Japan, then Ru Jing just told him to stay out of the cities. There's a reason for that kind of advice. Of course, it doesn't mean to never enter the city, you know, or something like that. But in the city, we're easily pulled by the constructed stuff. And we go out into nature, we're not. There isn't anything that way. We don't find straight lines or circles or anything. There's a kind of a freedom in that. But you're quite right. We don't actually have to go to these wild places necessarily. Though there we would find it in abundance. But just taking a walk down the sidewalk, you know, observing a tree as we're passing by. Yeah. Oh, thanks, Paul. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.